All right, so the first talk is The Last Silk Falls. The second one is going to be Silk and Slime, a description of spider silk glue. And then I'll talk about spider silk as a novel material. All of this is unpublished information, so hopefully you'll appreciate where we're going with a lot of this. So, all right, so as Cheryl showed, there are six different kinds of silk glands and a glue gland. And so what I'm going to talk about generally to start with are three silks, two of which Cheryl talked about, the major ampulate silk, also the minor ampulate silk, and then finally the flagelliform silk, because they have very different mechanical properties, as she indicated, to a small extent. And so we use that as a basis to try to begin to understand what it is that you need to have an ideal silk. And so this is a similar table to what she had, except throwing in the third silk now. So what you see is major ampulate silk, or dragline silk, high tensile strength, roughly comparable to that of Kevlar, elasticity substantially greater than Kevlar, and a very high energy to breaker toughness. Now, minor ampulate silk, on the other hand, has a lower tensile strength, actually has almost no elasticity. It actually elongates, but it irreversibly elongates. So it'll actually elongate about 20%, but it doesn't recover any of that. And so it has a lower energy to break. And finally, as Cheryl noted, flagelliform silk has a reasonably high tensile strength, but a huge elasticity or elongation. So it also has a very high energy to break. So we looked at each of those silks and asked the question, you know, what's unique about them in terms of sequence. The other interesting thing that I think it's important to recognize about spiders as compared to most of the other species that use silk, and that is that they have to produce the silk in a very rapid hurry. It's been estimated that when a spider falls, it has to produce the silk at about 100 centimeters per second. And so in a Nephila, the length of the duct here is about 2 centimeters. So it means that the transit time through there is less than a tenth of a second. So that means it has to go from a solution to a solid in a tenth of a second or less. And in that process, it has to have the mechanical properties it needs to save the spider when it falls. So that's a very unique proposition. And so it's something that a number of people are working on in trying to understand how this conversion process takes place. But to be honest about it, I think it's pretty simple. If you think about making spaghetti, if you think about spaghetti as all being balled up, each individual molecule is balled up so that it's forming interactions with itself. And then you imagine that you force that down through a funnel. What happens is frictional forces are sufficient to simply cause that ball to unravel. And so if you made lousy spaghetti, what happens is it sticks together. And that's exactly what these molecules do. As Cheryl noted, they're very large molecules. They're hundreds of thousands of kilodaltons. And so they're very large proteins. And what happens is instead of sticking themselves intermolecular, they start forming intermolecular interactions. And that just leads to exclusion of water, and bingo, you've got a fiber. And the fact is, we know it works. If I go in there with a pair of forceps and I grab that liquid and I pull like that, I make a fiber. So there's no magic necessary. It's really just a physical process that allows these molecules to align parallel to the fiber axis and exclude water. Now, this is where we're going to get deep into molecular sequences, but it's similar to what Cheryl showed. So the idea here is what we found is that every orb-weaving spider uses two proteins to make the dragline silk. What I've done is colored in the motifs, as Cheryl noted in hers. So you have a GGX motif in MASP1 as well as polyalanine. In MASP2, you have the GPGXX type sequences and polyalanine. The minor ampulate silks look very much like MASP1, except for the fact that instead of polyalanine, they've replaced that with long stretches of polyglyala. And then in the flagelliform sequence, you see there's virtually no glyala or polyala, but instead it's very long stretches of the GPGGX. And so we looked at that, and we used that then in our recombinant protein design. The other thing that Cheryl noted was the idea of molecular convergence. And convergence here, I think, is really in terms of three factors. The first is that all of the materials that are represented here are secreted from the cell, number one. Number two, they have to self-assemble without a template. So that is that the materials have to form on their own, whatever design properties they have to be embedded in the protein itself. And last but not least, they're obviously critical to the survival of the species. So you can see the polyalanine shows up in things like mollusk shell proteins, muscle attachment thread, as interestingly enough, to the GGX. The GPGXX is found in elastin, found in wheat gluten. That's why I use wheat to make raised bread and not things like rice and, and oats, because that in fact protein is the reason that as the CO2 in their bed, the dough rises. That's the protein that allows that elasticity. And also in the muscle attachment thread. And finally, the GX motif is found in a number of silk moths. So with that kind of introduction, I want to talk about the last silk to fall. So my lab has previously published on collaboration with a number of people on the sequences of five of the six silks. What you see here is the sixth silk called the piriform silk. That was the one that, unfortunately, it's impossible to get any mechanical testing on because what happens is it puts out hundreds of small fibers and it uses that as its attachment disc in terms of that. We've done this. What you see here is the repeat sequence, like Cheryl showed. So this sequence repeats over and over again. Again, the protein is huge, so we're only looking at the repeat sequence. These are from three species. Based on the phylogeny there, there's a separation of probably on the order of 125 million years, or at least a very long period, however you want to adjust that. And you can see that looking down below, you can see where the stars and the dashes are. The stars are where the sequence is identical. The dash is where there's a similar amino acid put in. And you can see how incredibly well conserved this particular repeat sequence is. The repeat sequence repeats over and over again in terms of that particular sequence. Just to give you an idea, this is a northern blot of cDNA. There's 9 kilobases, so we're talking something on the order of 12 to 13 kilobases. BU stands for butt. This is a butt cDNA library because the problem with the piriform glands, as opposed to all the rest of the glands, is they're embedded in the rear end of the spider. And so they sit right next to their spigots. And so we found it impossible to be able to actually separate those out. And so the postdoc and the undergrads who worked on this project actually did some separation here to separate it from acinophorum, but you can see that we still have some acinophorum silk in there. But you can see we have the piriform, but when we take the butt just at the very end where we can eliminate any acinophorum glands, you can see that we have a very clean western blot there. So that's the story with the last silk to fall. We're in the process of getting that ready for publication. But I think that there are a couple of particular interesting kinds of materials in there that are worth pursuing. And so the second part of the talk is to talk a little bit about the glue. And so this is kind of a unique situation that we ran into. And so what we did was is that Omer Koresh, a postdoc from Israel, actually took over 200 glands, 200 webs that we generated in the lab itself so we could keep them clean, and washed them of the glue protein. And in order to do that, it took over 200 webs to get enough material to run some SDS page gels. We ran those gels. First, we identified the fact that at least the major protein involved there was glycosylated, and so we had to deglycosylate that protein, run it again. Then we analyzed fragments of that by mass spec, then went back to a cDNA library that he contained to begin to isolate the proteins. And so this is what we call aggregland protein 1, and what you see in the dark area is a repetitive sequence that has some striking similarities to the mucins that are found in a lot of different organisms, including slugs and in humans. And so it repeats over and over again. You can see it's a fairly short repeat. And this is the entire protein. So we got the entire cDNA sequence of aggregate protein 1. We also found then that when we did the analysis of the mass spec, that there was a second protein. And so this is the second protein. And you can see down here there's a repetitive sequence here. It looks very much like silk. It's got valines, glycines, serines, and leucines. And it also repeats over and over again in terms of that. The really interesting thing is that when we compare the two proteins, what you find is they use identically the same DNA sequence. They read one strand in red, which is the silk sequence. They use the other strand reading in the other direction to generate the mucin strand. And so we found this in a number of silks, actually. And that is that when you go to do the DNA sequencing, that all six reading frames stay open. You end up with no stop codons in virtually every silk that you ever look at. So what the spider's done is co-opted that and generated, as far as we can tell, two separate genes And the reason that it's kept the DNA sequence identical is something that I don't have an answer to. But in a second, I'll show you that, in fact, not just one species, but three separate species have done exactly the same thing. This just goes to show when you do a Western blot to look at the mRNAs. Here's an mRNA for the number two. You can see it's got a different size, very different size than what you find for the first protein. And this just shows a comparison of two species. We actually have a third species that looks almost identically the same. In conversion from Mac to PC, there's a gap here that shouldn't be there. It should be moved over. But you can see, again, if you look at the amino acid sequence, it's almost identical. There's a few amino acid differences. But if you look at the second species, what you see is it's exactly the same thing. So in both species, the exact same DNA sequence has been used, including a 5-amino acid insert, if you will, in Clavipes compared to Gomoides. And here's exactly the same insert right there. So in the two different species, they've kept that DNA sequence identically the same. So to follow on with what Cheryl talked about in terms of some biophysical sorts of analyses, we know that the GGX sequence now, we've just published that on NMR sequence, what it forms is called a glycine 2 helix, and I'll show you a picture of that, the polyalanine sequence that Cheryl talked about, and then the GGX sequence. So I'll show you some slightly different pictures. This is the polyalanine sequence of van der Waals radii. And what happens is that the ball and stick model gives you a pretty good idea. This shows you exactly how tightly they pack together. They pack so tightly that water will not penetrate. So this silk doesn't dissolve because water never, ever can penetrate these particular crystalline regions. This is the glycine 2 helix. And what you can see is it looks exactly like a zipper. And I think that's exactly how it functions. What happens is that the residues on the X residue just simply interdigitate and make a zipper. So again, it locks the proteins together. This is a smaller version of the spiral that Cheryl showed, giving you an idea of the interactions here. Again, the X residues are critical because they're tyrosines and glutamines predominantly, and they allow each curl to link to the next one. So they allow the whole process to make the kind of spiral that we have. Now, it turns out that we've done some molecular dynamics simulations where you take a single molecule, you take 100 molecules of MASP2, and you do a molecular dynamics simulation. If you do just exactly like Cheryl did for a tensile strength, except you do it in the computer. So you tie down one end, and you pull it, and you ask, how much force does it take, and how far does it stretch? And here's just, again, ratioing to the diameter. The blue is the single fiber, the pink is the assembly, and the orange is a regular fiber. And you can see what happens is that it's very clear that the properties of the fiber are because of the properties of the protein. So you demonstrate exactly how things go by how the proteins are made. So what we've done is made a whole series of proteins in which we hold polyalanine the same, and we increase the elastic segment, or we hold the elastic segment the same, and increase the polyalanine segments. Just to give you an idea of what we've been doing, we in fact do most of our work in bacteria. Just to give you an idea of looking to the future, there's no way in the world you're ever going to make that a commercial process. The advantage is that it takes a very short time. From the time you make a gene to be able to get product, 2 to 4 months. It's really quite rapid. We now have transgenic goats. They make a tremendous amount. They make 15 grams per liter of the spider silk protein. And scale-up's relatively simple. You just breed more goats. The problem is that, again, it takes a couple years. We're doing work in alfalfa. We can get about 1% of the soluble protein to be the spider silk protein. So you can get about 218 kilos per acre per year. The real problem is that we're not sure how stable it is, and it takes quite a while to get to that point. So what we did in the first construct was to use the ArcGaia-PM ASP2 that Cheryl showed. There's the sequence. We either did one set, two sets, or three sets of the repeat, kept polyalanine the same. What we found was that if you only have one, you have a much stronger fiber. Two, you don't change things much, but when you go to the third one, you can see that elasticity has gone significantly higher. So we're almost a factor of 8 to 10 higher in elasticity, but we've lost a lot of tensile strength. Now, I'll come back to it, but one of the things that it's clear the spiders are doing is what's called post-spin draw. So that is, after the fiber forms, almost all manufacturers then stretch it. And we haven't factored that into our spinning process yet. So that's one of the reasons why we see it there. So we took the elastic segment from the flagelliform seek. What happens there is there's GPGGA or GPGGY, and we made one A and we made one the YS combination. That's the question, are they different? Why does the spider use both of these? And the other interesting thing is that in the purification process, turns out that these are perfectly stable to heat. So in fact, the very first thing you do is take your E. coli extract and you simply heat it. And what happens is all of these proteins precipitate out of solution, and there's your silk protein right there using a Western blot. And you can see that in fact it's staying in solution very, very nicely. The other thing that's interesting is in the purification process, we put a HIS tag there so that they'd actually be able to use a HIS-bind column. You can see the fiber starting to form as the drops are coming out of the column. So we know that we have the ability to make these. So we actually can take that solution now and pull fibers from it, which we call hand drawing. It also turns out that we can dissolve them up in an organic solution, use a machine designed to spin fibers, and do there. So what we found was that when you take it from an aqueous solution, that you actually get much better fibers. But if you compare the A's and the Y's, the first thing is that you see that the fibers have a pretty high variation. And that's also found in the natural spiders. And we don't understand where that variation comes from. But you can see there's fibers that are very elastic and not as strong, or very strong and not nearly as elastic in terms of being able to do that. But from the aqueous solution, you can see that in general, particularly in the Y series, they're much stronger and they're much more elastic, regardless of which, they're 10 times as elastic when we take it from water as we've done from the organic solution. We now know, although I haven't got the data consolidated here, that if you do a post-spin draw, you actually increase the elasticity and the tensile strength by anywhere from a factor of 2 to a factor of 10. So the post-spin draw is clearly going to be critically important. This just shows some basic numbers. You can see that if we look at toughness, in this one, from water you get 10 times tougher, and you get something that's almost 20 times more elastic. Second set, using the Nephelocleipes MASP2. Here what we did was increase polyalanine, 4, 8, and 16. And this just goes to show the data. Interestingly enough, there's a fairly minimal amount of difference in terms of tensile strength, which surprises me in terms of certainly what we expected. The other thing is that when you look at the energy to break or strength to break, you can see that in fact there are some substantial differences. These fibers have all been stretched a factor of 2. So after they were formed, we did a post-spin draw factor of 2. If you don't do that, they actually end up down around here and have less than 1% elongation. So it makes a huge difference there. The last thing I want to show is what we're doing in terms of some NMR work. And what we're trying to do is put C13 or N15 labels into the spiders themselves. And what happens is people usually do it for 3 or 4 days. And what we found is that one of the graduate students in my lab is that in fact you need to go out to substantially longer times to be able to see it. And so this just shows the C13 spectra. You can see that if you compare silk taken 3 days, 3, 4, and 5, compared to 11 and 12, you can see how much more C13 you get in there. Now what we used that for was to compare our fibers that we've spun from MASP1 and compare that to the natural silk. And you can see with MASP1, we're actually fairly close. So in fact, the green at the bottom is the natural silk here. And you see that we're fairly close with our MSP1 fibers in terms of being able to spin those to look like what the natural fibers have. However, we're lousy at MASP2. And that's what we've been spending most of our time working on. You can see that basically in MASP2, we have almost no beta sheet. That instead what the polyalanines are probably doing is forming a small spiral. And they don't elongate into the beta sheet. So it's very clear that we still have to sort of figure out the spinning process if we're going to have the chance to match this. However, I should say that, in fact, we have, on occasion, gotten MASP2 and MASP1 fibers that are very similar, if not exceeding, the natural silks. So the other key thing is, remember I said that in every species that we've looked at for dragline silk, they always use MASP1 and MASP2 together. And so we're in the process now of using those two in various combinations to spin fibers. And that's the question, you know, what are we missing? Because obviously we're not doing as well as the spider is. So we're expecting that by putting the two silk proteins together, that we can get a much closer match to what Mother Nature has done. Finally, there's the people who've been doing the work over the last several years, and those people who've paid to keep me happy. Thanks. Questions? Yeah.
Is the length of the tube between the spider's sort of fluid reservoir and the end where it emerges, does that dictate the properties of the silk?
No. As best we can tell, no, because you can take a look at the orb weavers that are big and the orb weavers that are small, and as Cheryl showed, the mechanical properties, by the time you put a standard error on there, that's one of the things we haven't quite figured out how to do, they're just not different.
How's the diameter of a silk fiber determined?
That's also a very good question. The spider has some control over it by a muscular valve that's on there. What we know is that if you look right before it hits the valve, right before it hits the spigot, in fact, the fiber is now smaller than the actual tube, and it's actually floating on a little water layer. So it may be that they have some ability to do that by holding off and getting some post-spin draw into there. But I think for the most part, it's the diameter of the tube, so as the spiders get bigger, the tube gets bigger, and the diameter of the fiber gets bigger. Yeah? A practical reason only in terms of the idea was that the company that collaborated with us to do this wanted a very rapid turnaround because they're a biotech company. Turns out there are goats from South Africa called belly goats, and so they're actually sexually mature at 6 months, and that's much earlier than almost all the rest of them. So what it meant was that they could breed them much earlier and lactate them much earlier. And so the goats we have now are not the belly goats, which are little itty bitty goats. These are great big 200-pound milking goats that have been converted. It was just because it's much faster to be able to do it. To do cows takes at least twice, almost three times as long, because there's no breed of cows that matures early enough sexually that you don't have about an 18-month wait. I can tell you in 3 days. Whether that's going to work. One of my postdocs is right now back at Notre Dame working with some people there. So we've actually made the construct. It's based on flagelliform silk because we wanted to do something that was different completely than what the natural was. The problem with it is that all of the silkworms now that have been mutagenized that don't make the proper cocoon actually are only using a light chain. And so what we need is a knockout for the heavy chain or a way to do a recombination. So I have a feeling it's not gonna work in this case, but we'll see at least if we get any silk incorporated.
How did you actually do the post-stretch?
What happens is the machine that we have actually has two wheels, and it goes around the first wheel, and you make the second wheel spin faster than the first wheel. It's really pretty simple, and then you can use various. You can either dip it through. So we've dipped it in methanol. Turns out to be a horrible idea. All these people who've done used methanol with silk proteins to make them better. If we use methanol on our proteins, those things just are absolutely brittle and break. You can't even test them.
What you do with the second stretch, the post stretch, is stretching any more doing good? What is it actually doing?
I think what happens is that our spinning process is not as good as a spider, so that we're not elongating those huge long molecules, and so they're balling up. And so when they ball up, they don't interact in the right way, and so we lose the interactions that we need. And so if you stretch it, I think you just physically elongate those proteins so that they make more correct sort of interactions. Yeah? Mass producing, I think the goats are probably going to be the way to go for biomedical applications. I think the plant is the only way to go. We've got somebody who if it works for them, wants 200 kilos a day. And there's just no way to do that except to do a very large plant kind of a thing. The kinds of things that people are excited about, as soon as we get done making some, we've got people that are going to be implanting for artificial ligaments. Right now, there is no artificial ligament. If you blow out your ACL like I've done, You know, they go somewhere else or they go to a cabin. There is no synthetic replacement available. Certainly people are talking about it for protective clothing. I think that actually our very first product, if we can get it work, is going to be for those people who are fly fishermen, for fly fishing tippets, because fly fishermen will pay a whole lot of money. You take a look, 9 feet, they'll pay $8 for 9 feet of tippet. I can make money at that. We can produce it cheap enough. And you know, I'm a fly fisherman, so you know, I can say they're snobs or whatever else, but if I could make something out there that meant that they wouldn't lose as many fish, I guarantee I got a sale. Okay, thanks.